This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. The oil spill off the Gulf Coast is most certainly an environmental problem, but it's also turning into a political problem. President Obama is a supporter of more offshore drilling, while many governors are backing away from the notion. Also, international nuclear disarmament talks continue while Iran and North Korea are viewed to be the biggest threats and the least willing to talk. And four countries in Europe are teetering on the edge of economic meltdown. It's Politics Day. We'll talk about those issues with our regular guests, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire. We'll also take your calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. Talk of Iowa is coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. It's Politics Day, and our regular guests are with us. Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, joins us from our Ames studio. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, political analyst from New Hampshire, is on the line. Morning, Arnie.
And I may be joining you from Ames or Des Moines next Friday, so there
we
you
hope
go.
So. That would be fabulous. So let's start with oil. There's a lot of it in the Gulf of Mexico, if you hadn't heard, and clearly an environmental issue. I'd like to ask both of you, start out this morning with, what's your take on what the political ramifications of this, especially considering that the Obama administration was for more offshore drilling, now governors of both parties are saying they don't want it. What's the political ramification of that oil leak?
First, I think, if I might say, I don't think the Obama administration was in favor of it, but they were being basically pushed by Republicans to come on board an energy bill and a global warming bill, and the Republicans wanted concessions, and one of the concessions was more offshore oil drilling, because remember, Palin and McCain and Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich's motto was drill, baby, drill, and so the Republicans felt that that would be an issue that they could push. So I don't think the Obama administration was ever crazy about it. They thought they could throw it as a concession to the Republicans to get the climate bill moving, and I think, in fact, now they're relieved that they can say, well, you know, we're not going to move in that direction now. And remember Brownie, heck of a job, Brownie, who was the head of FEMA under Bush and kind of blew the New Orleans Katrina disaster. He said on his radio show, and it's a big hoopla right now on the internet, that he thought that the Obama administration had deliberately not responded to this spill quickly in order to make it into this big disaster, and that they were happy it was a big disaster because now they can bail out of the drilling offshore. So that's how bad it's gotten.
Well, and just remember that George Bush hired Brownie. George Bush hired Brownie. George Bush hired Brownie. I mean, right. This is to show you how incompetent the hire was and how it continues to exude incompetence. But the sad thing about Obama's response really goes back to BP's answer, which was, in the beginning, there was no spill. That's what BP said. There was no spill. Then there was 1,000 gallons. Then there was 5,000. Now we don't even know. It's 25,000. And it's not a spill. It's a gusher, Jonathan. It is not a spill. You know, this thing is just spouting oil. You know, a spill, it's like a tanker. You know what's in a tanker. You know how many gallons. You know when it empties out. Do you know when this is going to empty out? Do you know when this is going to stop? Do you know how many millions of gallons may ultimately come into the ocean? We have no idea. This is not a spill. This is a gusher. It is a very different thing, and sadly, what I just wrote a piece for Insider Iowa. So go to the politics section. Michael Kroll, who works with Newt Gingrich, and myself write a red and blue column, and we wrote a column about offshore oil drilling. And my title was "Don't Ask, Don't Drill." And the reason I'm disgusted with Barack Obama is that I understand that he has a new line, and it not only applies to energy, it applies to nuclear, it applies to everything. And I don't mean nuclear energy, I mean even nuclear bombs. And that is, everything is on the table. Now, can I just share something with you? Everything is on the table is not leadership. It is a punt. Because ultimately, we must make choices. And certain things do not, I repeat, do not belong on the table. And there is an irony here, not just what Brownie said about that the Obama administration was, you know, slow to respond because they wanted this, you know, disaster to happen. But it turns out, did you know that on Monday night, BP was supposed to get an award from the government
yes.
for safety and security?
For one of the oil companies with the best record, yeah. Well.
Okay, on Monday. There's another irony here, because BP kept saying, this will never happen, this will never happen. We have gotten better at this. What we have gotten better at doing is causing a disaster that we can't even comprehend.
So who ends up paying the political price for this? The Republicans who were chanting drill, baby, drill not too many months ago, the Obama administration for at some level supporting more offshore drilling, and some questions about the government's response to this. Who's the biggest political loser in this?
I'm not sure that there is going to be a loser. The casualty of this is that it's going to be much, much more difficult now to expand the territories that are designated as drillable, where there are reserves identified offshore, because, as you said, we kind of knew this would happen, because I wrote a piece, I think, last week maybe on this. You know, the value of the coastline, the fishing, the recreation, the tourism, the boating is very great, and it's permanent. It's a renewable resource, and it's sustainable. And if you wreck it like this, the cost to the local economy is enormous. Now, we need oil in this country because we are still very dependent, and even with all of the energy independence moves and solar and wind and, you know, electric cars and so on, we still need oil for many, many, many decades. So the dilemma is, we need the stuff. The Gulf of Mexico is filled with rigs. We import much too much now from countries that are in risky areas or have risky regimes, and so we're still stuck with the question of, where do we get it?
Well, can I also say something? I mean, when do we exhibit the kind of remarkable behavior that says America can learn to change on a dime? When we were attacked as a result of World War II, everybody changed. We developed victory gardens. Women went to work in factories. Everybody changed. You know, we understood the assault. We were terrified. We saw what happened in Hawaii. We had to respond quickly. And all of us instantly behavior patterns changed. Look at what is happening here. We are talking about, you know, in the piece I wrote, I said, isn't there an irony here that New Orleans will have survived a Hurricane Katrina, which basically was a natural disaster that was probably made much worse by bad human behavior, both in response and in what they've done to the boot of Louisiana, you know, with the offshore drilling and everything else, and a lot of the vegetation that has now disappeared. But isn't it ironic that this entirely man-made catastrophe may be the thing that does it under?
Yeah.
You know,
this
is a real problem.
I'd like to share an email we got from Jack, who says he'd like the panel to consider that this oil spill will translate into a political gift to President Obama on the issue of energy reform. There will be a massive call to change how America does energy, and that's what Obama's been calling for. He's consistently called for an investment in alternative sources. The resistance to regulate the energy industry is quickly falling by the wayside. Witness Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, number one supporter of offshore drilling, is now calling for more stringent control. So Jack believes that this is actually going to make President Obama a winner in the long term. Steph Arney, your reaction to that?
I
agree. How are we doing on financial reform?
Well, okay. I, you know, it depends on whether he pushes back enough. It depends on how he decides to roll with this, because as Arnie says, you know, he's had opportunities and he sometimes is a little bit timid on those. So the oil industry is very, very powerful. The oil industry, let's talk about too big to fail. We have banks that are too big to fail, insurance companies that are, and the auto industry too big to fail. Well, the oil industry is too big to fail. We can't let it fail. So we have to be very careful. If we smash it apart and really, you know, take it on too hard, you know, they're going to say, well, fine. You know, then you figure out how you're going to run your cars. So it's a dilemma. We're stuck with it. The airlines are too big to fail too, by the way. And now we have only two or three airlines left, you know, but with the merger.
There's going to be one, and it's just going to be called Airline.
That's right.
I just came back.
Generic airline in a brown envelope.
An aside here, I just came back from New York City. In fact, guess where I was on Saturday night?
No, Times Square, O'Arnie.
Times Square.
You're always in the right place at the wrong time.
That's where I was. I was in Times Square. I mean, talk about being crazy. But we were literally just driving out of Times Square as they were shutting it behind us.
Wow.
Okay, I mean, talk about scary.
Yeah.
But actions have consequences. And I think that we need to know that we can change behavior, but there will be consequences to that. And my stepson gives beer tours in New York City.
How cool is that?
He gives beer tours. But you know what he told us? He said when they suddenly made the idea of, what was it, abstinence, you could not drink alcohol. What was that called?
Prohibition.
Prohibition, thank you very much. When they had prohibition, what happened was that since people couldn't drink beer or alcohol, they started drinking soda. Okay? And what that suddenly did was give America a very interesting new taste bud. It was called the sweet bud. And now everything had to be sweet. Even when beer came back, it had to be sweeter than before. And you know the rest of the story. I'm looking at obesity. I'm looking at everything. And it may even go back to prohibition, as remarkable as it sounds. But we all know that actions have consequences. You're absolutely right, Stefan. We know that if we shut down oil, that there will be consequences to that. But I'm trying to figure out what the consequences are. Let's see. We might not have to commit as much of our land resources to highways. We might actually have to deal with some of the problems that oil has created to pollution. We may suddenly see more Cape winds off the coast and more offended, you know, very rich people who are going to see these wind turbines. I am looking at what are the consequences of alternative energy versus what are the consequences if we continue to run in place. What are the consequences? I learned about the consequences of prohibition, which turns out it was obesity. No one ever thought that that would happen. You can actually go back in almost a line of demarcation when America developed its sweet tooth, and it goes to there. So I want all of us to play this out. If we suddenly decide that we have to address aggressively a changed energy future, let's talk about the positive consequences and the negative consequences. And I hate to say it, but I see more potential for positives here than I see in any way, shape, or form for negatives.
Isn't that – it's not the American way, though. We want an immediate fix right now that takes care of everything.
Yeah.
Well, we have to be raised by different parents. I'm telling you right now.
We're coming up on a break, and after our break, we're going to take a couple more phone calls on this issue, the oil spill in the Gulf. And then after that, we'll talk about nuclear disarmament talks that are going on and how North Korea and Iran play into those discussions or lack thereof. That's coming up. More of your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire's Arnie Arneson will be with us as when we come back in a minute here on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt, Arnie Arneson are here. We're taking your calls and emails. Right now we're talking about the oil spill leak gusher, what have you, in the Gulf Coast.
Sorry.
Let's take a phone call. Dave in Des Moines is on the line. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. I always love you. You're always so insightful. I'm a former Coast Guardsman, and I just – that comment that – that knucklehead Brownie had about the, you know, the response. There isn't a Coast Guardsman alive or dead that wouldn't give their best. We had 33,000 people rescued in New Orleans before Brownie knew he had a problem.
Yeah.
I'm really getting tired of this divisiveness. We need to pull together, and we need to shut down the motor mouse. Thank you.
You know,
how do you really feel? Yeah.
No, but his point is so well taken because this is so outrageous. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, you know what he actually said about the oil spill? He said, well, oil is natural, just like water. Excuse me? I'm like, what?
Yeah, when it's down under the rocks, it is.
I'm going to say drink it. I mean, if it's just like water, have a beverage. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Sonia from Ames is on the line. Sonia, welcome to the show.
Hi. I was listening to you talk about that we need to just, cut the oil, stop the drilling, whatever, which would be great. But the consequences one of the consequences I think you have to talk about is the cost of food, because the cost of our food, we have a transportation system, not a a food system. So people's food is going to, our food system is totally going to have to change. Mm.
Well, that's
well, some people would think that's a good thing. There's certainly a lot of advocates that the slow food movement.
But we're not set up to do that right now. I mean, it'd be great, but that's not going to happen overnight.
But isn't this wonderful? We have to start talking like this. What are the consequences? And you're absolutely right. The consequences of you know, detaching ourselves from oil are plastics. The consequences of detaching ourselves from oil are transportation. How do we get our food here? I mean, but we have to talk about what are the consequences, because we are so afraid by what it might be that we never talk about it. We never talk about how can we adjust. People are now talking about locavores and farmers markets and growing locally, and people are so ticked off because everything that you buy in Walmart comes from China. Well, you know what? If it suddenly becomes really expensive to ship something from China, we may start making things again.
Well, the other thing is there was
all these other issues.
Well, but also provided that we're willing to spend twice as much money on food.
Yeah. Well,
that's the other consequence.
You spend whatever you have to. You know, that's true everywhere in the mm-hmm. world. You adjust your personal budget to what the economy delivers to you. But the other thing is, we had an interesting article this weekend about a research group at Iowa State that is going to field test this summer an engine which runs on ammonia, and all it puts out, it's basically kind of a nitrogen-driven vehicle. That's the fuel. No petroleum, nothing. And that is very exciting, because if we can move in that direction, we can rapidly create vehicles that run very much like a petroleum-driven vehicle, diesel or gasoline. It wouldn't look that different. It would have an engine that would be very similar, but it would use a different fuel, which can be manufactured pretty much anywhere out of thin air, practically. And so, you know, whenever there are these thresholds, exciting things start to happen. People start innovating and inventing, and entrepreneurs and especially investors, you know, venture capitalists and others start getting very excited about stimulating something new.
I think we can
do this. And we're doing the same thing in Nevada, Iowa, where I live. There is a plant that is also an experimental plant run by scientists from Iowa State. And they're taking garbage, and they're basically processing literally garbage and turning it into a fuel that is very similar to kind of a crude oil or diesel fuel. And we have plenty of garbage in this country. We don't know where to put it. And so there are things that are just on the horizon. They're not really very far away, and they're not unrealistic. And, you know, if we can get those moving, and if we can go, you know, the old paranoid story is that the oil companies bought the patents to all of those carburetors when cars still had carburetors that could get 150 miles per gallon on fuel, and that they locked those up in their safe in their central conspiracy headquarters, wherever that is. If we can get those carburetors out, maybe we can, you know, really get that gas mileage up, and we can rapidly change our dependence on both foreign oil and also oil that's produced with you know, with real serious potential side effects for other values that we have. So,
well, let's move on to nuclear talks. If you have a comment or question on this, talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100. International talks, nuclear treaties going on, but it seems like this is a much different level of discussion than it might have been 20 or 30 years ago, because instead of superpowers with thousands and thousands of missiles talking to each other about who's the bigger threat, it's smaller countries that may have one or two or a rogue cell that might get one. Steph Arney, do you guys think that nuclear armament is going to be something that is going to really be at the forefront of international politics in the coming year?
AQ Khan. Oh, excuse me. Did I mention his name? And that is the father of nukes in Pakistan. And it isn't it interesting that it all is going to end up going back to Pakistan? What just happened in Times Square goes back to Pakistan. When you look at the rise of Al-Qaeda and you look at the growth of terrorism, it goes back to Pakistan. When you start worrying about who is going to get access to these nukes, you are worried about Pakistan because of AQ Khan. It all goes back to this, and I think it's so fascinating because there's a fabulous piece in CNN, actually it was in response to what happened in Times Square, but he went to Pakistan and he said, part of the problem with Pakistan is it has been so worried about India, another nuclear power, that the military in Pakistan has aided and abetted the terrorists, has aided and abetted Al-Qaeda, has basically, you know, promoted AQ Khan to almost a deity status, but in the end, in their attempt to, you know, push back on India, they may in fact be at the heart of what we are so concerned about, which is that it doesn't get into the hands of an India or a Pakistan, but it gets into the hands of a guy that screwed up in Times Square. I mean, oh, how scary. Oh,
well,
how
scary. You know, and the thing is, of course, now a lot of stable, serious states are on board with wanting to rope in the nukes and reduce their numbers. I saw some interesting discussions. The U.S. isn't going to go non-nuclear because the nuclear threat that the United States has, even with a vastly reduced arsenal, is still the big deterrent against state-sponsored terrorism or state-sponsored attack against the United States. I mean, it is the ultimate doomsday club. You know, they can do a lot of things to us, but they're not going to have the rain of fire that we can bring down on them if, God forbid, they should do something stupid. So I think the U.S. is going to retain a small nuclear arsenal. Then the U.S. is developing these new weapons that we saw revealed last week, and it was last week when I lectured on foreign policy, which is a super secret project, and it is a new bomb that is non-nuclear but has the same explosive capability of a nuclear weapon, and it can be delivered pinpoint. You know, they can target it by firing it with a rocket, and then it flies very high on a kind of a glider, and then it can be steered down right through your living room window. And when that happens, the explosion is the size of a nuclear explosion. And that's a non-nuclear alternative to the nuclear arsenal. So there are things going on at all kinds of different levels. But it's true that loose nukes rolling around is still more a scary kind of proposition than state-sponsored use of nuclear weapons. And if Iran develops nuclear weapons, then the question is, are they going to slip some to a few individuals who will use them on their enemies, not just the U.S., but also their local enemies, in which case that would be, you know, a whole different scenario, I guess.
You see, I don't know what Obama's approach is, because I'm afraid that Obama's approach is very similar to his approach on energy, which is everything is on the table when it comes to nuclear. And I'm looking at the five key objectives of our nuclear weapons posture, okay? Yeah. I'm looking at the five, very pithy. Preventing nuclear proliferation and terrorism. Reducing the role of U.S. nuclear weapons in U.S. national security strategy, maintaining strategic deterrence and stability at reduced nuclear force levels, and then strengthening regional deterrence, sustaining a safe, secure, and effective nuclear arsenal. Okay?
Yeah.
Sounds like everything's on the table. We're going to have fewer, but we're going to be sustaining. We're going to be effective.
Sure.
I mean, what does that tell you? Yeah. Everything is on the table when it comes to nukes. There is no real change.
Well, and we'll wrap up our discussion about nuclear discussion. We'll also talk about the economies in Europe. What's that going to mean for us?
Oh,
we'll talk about that after this break with the Environment Report here on Talk of Iowa. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests. Your phone calls and emails as well after this break. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson are here. It's Politics Wednesday on the show. Your emails at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also call us at 866-780-9100. And Stephen, Arnie, I'd like to talk about pigs.
Oh, boy.
Oh, no. Oh, I know. Portugal, Spain.
Portugal, Italy,
Ireland.
Greece, and Spain.
Right.
Those four countries are often referred to with that acronym because of their troubled economies in Europe. and what that might mean to the European Union and in turn to the rest of the world. Greece is going through a massive bailout funded in large part by other countries and austerity measures that include cuts in benefits, pay, pensions, and it's leading to riots so bad there have even been deaths in Greece. So, Stefan Arney, what role does the U.S. play in here, and to what extent do these economies have the ability to foreshadow things that could happen in other parts of the world?
Well, I, you know, people my age start thinking about when they might retire, and I'm not thinking about that very hard anymore because the American stock market is very vulnerable, and any American savings and investments are very vulnerable, not only to Bank of America and Citigroup and J.P. Morgan and, you know, the housing market and so on in the United States, but they're also vulnerable through those same entities that I just mentioned, and it includes Goldman Sachs and you know, State Street Bank and so on, because those American banks are invested $176 billion in exposure to the pigs. And so anything that happens in Greece or in Spain or in Portugal or in Italy, and there's also Ireland and Austria are also part of this problem, is going to seriously undermine the value of American banks and stocks and undermine the economic recovery of countries around the world. And, you know, my students are freshmen mostly in this class this semester, and they are not that interested in Greece. And I try to explain to them, guys, you have to be interested in what's going on beyond the college town here, because this is a totally interrelated world. And when something happens in another country that is economically a very disturbing event, it does affect you and it does affect me and it does affect the taxes that are paid in Iowa that pay for part of your college tuition. So that's how we should be worried about it, because the crisis that unfolded was not a crisis of American banks or American, the housing market and mortgages and so on. It was a business model that was spread worldwide, not just in the U.S., that led countries to rock and roll with money they didn't have on speculation and on a highly exaggerated sense of what anything was worth. And Spain is the best example. Spain was the model country of Europe. It was, you know, I remember the beautiful articles with color pictures. You know, Spain is the most livable country in Europe. It's booming. The cities are growing. Everybody is rich and everybody's doing well. And Barcelona and Madrid are the most beautiful cities to go to. And it turned out that most of it was basically a fantasy based on these wildly exaggerated expectations of what houses were worth and real estate was worth and how you really run an economy. You know, so we're having to go and reexamine pretty much everything.
There's a wonderful, wonderful blog called Naked Capitalist, and it's written by Eve Smith. And she has written today about Greece, Germany, and the dangers of beggar thy neighbor. But there's one thing I want you to hear what she says. And what she says is that, you know, the global financial rescue we just went through? She said the supposedly successful rescue of the global financial system was achieved by making sure bank investors took no pain.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And what then she goes on to say, the effect of the bank rescues was a massive transfer from the citizenry to financiers, the greatest looting of the public purse in history, and the perps have behaved in a singularly ungrateful fashion, paying themselves record bonuses a year after being saved from their own greed and recklessness, and adding insult to injury by carrying on all too frequently about how talented and invaluable they are. And you have to read. This woman is unbelievable. And I think that's part of the problem. But you also have two situations that are not the same but similar. And I think this was an article from the LA Times. And that we in the United States represent capitalism gone wild. What happened in Europe is kind of socialism gone wild. And both of them need to be controlled. No, both of them need to be put in check. Both of them have to understand that there is a bill that must be paid. And I think that as a result, we kind of are similar but different in the problems that we created. And it goes back to what your mother says. You know, you have to be measured. You have to be reasonable. There needs to be checks and balances. There needed to be rules and regulations that were enforced, because a deregulated market is a market that allows those financiers to go out of control, because in the end, it's not really deregulated, because they always know that our public purse is available to them. Well, and the same is true in Europe.
And in a country like Greece, and this is also true in Spain and a couple of other countries, there has been this totally unrealistic standard of living, especially, for example, for government employees. I mean, their benefits, their salaries, their retirement age, everything is wildly out of proportion to the reality of the economy from which they're sucking these resources. And what we're seeing on the streets in Greece is the power, especially of public unions. They won't give up anything, and they want it all, even though the country is not producing the kind of revenue that you could possibly sustain that kind of standard of living on. And there was a frightening article that I saw in probably the New York Times, could have been the Wall Street Journal, about the public compensation of government employees in the United States, especially, you know, county and municipal and other, at that level, state employees, not necessarily federal. And it said, there we also have a compensation and a retirement system that is completely outdated, that was based on a kind of illusion of maybe the 1980s, 70s and 80s of what was affordable. The most government employees have pensions, so that their compensation is guaranteed and is not tied at all to the performance of the economy. They don't have 401ks. They have a pension that when they retire, they get paid a fixed amount of money, regardless of whether the economy can still sustain that or not. And those are all, let's call them, political economy questions that are brutally difficult, you know, to reform and revise, because the workers in Greece don't want to give up anything. The workers in Germany have given up a lot and are saying, we've tried to be very careful here in how we spend our money, and now we're having to bail out the Greeks, who are completely irresponsible on all this, and we're paying for it. So Angela Merkel is in big trouble, because the Germans are saying, why do we have to bail out the Greeks under this European economy, who have basically not been as careful as we have, and now we're having to pay for it.
But we've created a circular firing squad, is what's happened. Everyone's shooting everybody else. But in the end, I go back to what Eve said, which is that part of the reason why there's this huge resentment on the part of many of the Greek workers to what they're being forced to eat is that they see the mistakes made by their government. They see the bankers and the financiers being bailed out, and because none of that bailout went to the little people. I mean, that's why people are so angry in this country. They're angry because Goldman Sachs got bailed out, and everybody in half a state of, like, in the South, in Arizona, Nevada, lost their homes to these subprime products and all these other mortgage products that they came up with to be so creative so they could make their fast million. I think people are saying, wait a minute, have we shared the pain? I will exhibit some sort of reasonableness if I see all of us sharing the pain. But instead, I see my pain being exacerbated because I am paying some fat, wealthy fat cat additional money so they experience no pain and make even more profit because they're too important. Well, no, they're not.
Well, and it's so interesting, Jonathan. There was a terrific article that enumerated the percentage of people in Greece who actually pay income tax.
Yes, exactly.
And it's ridiculous. It's like, I can't remember what the number was, so I don't want to say a number because somebody...
Well, I think on NPR this morning they said that Greece loses somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 billion a year in unpaid income taxes.
Well, they said, you know, what percentage of Greeks actually file, and it was ludicrous. It was very, very low. So the Greeks are doing what people around the world try to do, which is to basically not pay any taxes, even if they can afford to. So it's a matter of enforcing the law, it's a matter of, you know, doing away with corruption. It's a matter of everybody, including the middle class, has to share, because if you take all the wealth away from the richest, you still don't have enough to make a society actually function. And that's been shown over and over again by economists. So everybody has to contribute regularly. And then the government has to be careful and has to be a good steward of public resources, of tax revenue, so that it's used wisely and isn't just splattered around for you know, big Olympics that produce giant buildings that are never used again and all kinds of other crazy stuff.
The reality is that we're looking at excess. We are looking at excess in socialized countries. We're looking at excess in capitalist countries. And your mother always told you, never eat anything bigger than your head. And yet, ultimately, look what happened both here and in Europe. You know, and then it turns out that it was our bad financiers that basically said, look, you can do more with nothing. But you should be able to do nothing with nothing. So no one reigned in Greece at a time when they should have been reigned in, when the problem wasn't so much worse.
And our banks helped Greece.
Yes.
Our banks helped Greece by covering this up.
Yes.
I mean, there is you know, absolutely bulletproof evidence that American banks helped Greece cover up the condition in which their banking system was, especially their sovereign debt, which is the government debt. And so American banks were accomplices in postponing Greece, basically facing the fact that they were living way beyond what was realistic with investments that really weren't worth at all what, you know, they were putting on their books. And I think that's another disturbing, really corruption of the American banking system. We shouldn't be doing that. Our banks shouldn't be doing that. That's what little banks in the Cayman Islands used to do, you know, when people could put their money into secret accounts there. But American banks should be transparent on this and should help to stabilize the world economy.
Let's get to a call. Bob in Bettendorf is on the line. Bob, you have a comment on this topic?
Yes, I do. Our economy at the local level largely has been based upon the city encouraging the inflation of real estate values by rolling out the red carpet for developments of McMansions to replace modest small houses. They want that because then their tax base increases and they have more money to pay their city workers. Basically, the local aldermen had been rolling over for the city workers and municipal workers. And in the state of Illinois, they had 15,000 of these people invade Springfield, screaming and shouting, raise our taxes. These people are already making 150% of what people in the private economy make. And by the way, that article was in the Wall Street Journal that Stefan referred to about how the municipal employees are a large part of the problem. And the governor of New Jersey is a saint, in my eyes, for the way he's trying to battle this problem.
Yeah, there was an interesting article about the new Governor Christie, I think is his name, and how he's sort of trying to go out there and be, you know, the white hat and trying to rein in all of this, and I'll bet you he'll fail.
Well, I guess in defense of public employees, although I'm not always sure that I want to defend them, but I do want to remind everyone that what public employees sacrificed was the opportunity for huge profit and gain. So what they said is, we will go and we will be reasonable. We will defer any kind of – see, you're actually paying a public employee for their retirement and their health care. Because instead of making the potential of $80,000, I don't know where you're getting $150,000, but instead of making the $80,000 to $100,000 to $120,000, like my brother the banker was making at the very beginning of his career, they said we'll start at a modest $30,000. But because we start at a modest $30,000, part of our compensation is to know that we're going to have a retirement package. Part of our compensation is to know that we're going to have a health care package. And I don't know about you, but I suspect that you probably want a retirement package and you want a health care package. And the difference is that we were sold a bill of goods that your 401k was going to be a great retirement package because you could make potentially more money, God help you if you retired 2 years ago, and that your health care package was going to be just wonderful, and then you find out you don't have a union and you're eating more and more of your premium and you have a higher and higher copay and you have a huge deductible. So the fact of the matter is that what public employees have is what most of us want. Most of us have lost that. Now, is the answer to take it away from them or to ask how come we don't have it? What happened to our pensions? What happened to our affordable health care? And so the answer isn't taking away from public employees because you're not solving the problem. You're just exacerbating the problem.
And I certainly don't want to take away from anybody, but what's happened also, Arnie, is that the exuberance about the American economy, the amount of revenue that was coming into the coffers with real estate prices at this highly inflated and unrealistic rate made it possible for unions to negotiate better packages that were based on an economy that was anticipated at that point. And it turns out the American economy isn't anywhere near as robust as we had estimated. And so what you've got is these pack, and that's true in higher education as well. I mean, the, you know, the compensation packages that you get as a professor in a university and so on is very good. We don't get pensions. I mean, we have to put money into a savings account and then it's usually matched, but we're not guaranteed anything. But it was based on an economy that had an upward curve going, at a very steep curve in terms of what this country's GDP was and what the tax revenue was that you could be compensated on. And that's, it seems to me, has been greatly diminished. And so we've got these enormous obligations sitting there and continuing to build, for which the economy is not really performing. And so that's another way of looking at the problem that we have to sort of rethink this.
You're absolutely right about real estate. There's no question. If you're going to be property tax dependent, then the way that you acquire wealth is that you build more, is that it becomes more extravagant, you have more commerce, you have larger houses, because all of those will produce what you desperately need, which is greater property tax revenue. And if it turns out that your property taxes aren't doing it, what's the new tax du jour? It's not really a tax, it's called gambling. So the next thing we know is, well, if we can't raise people's real estate because the real estate market has gone to hell in a handbasket, then we're going to put a casino on every corner.
Don't bring up gambling.
After all, that's going to get...
Don't bring up gambling in Iowa right now, Arnie.
Oh, I'm sure.
Our governor is up to his neck in controversy over the four new casinos that he would like to build and the $25,000 that allegedly were given to his campaign through a third party
But it's the same thing. Yeah. Is that you're always looking for those additional dollars. And at some point in time, people have to recognize, what is it that we can afford as a community, and how do we find the money in a rational and reasonable way? And as soon as there's a burst of additional revenue, everyone thinks it's going to be sustained forever, and it never is.
Well, we always spend it. I mean, we build new projects. You know, we build water slide projects and water parks and all that, because all of a sudden, you know, there's all this money. And very often, wealthy people give money to communities and say, I want the, you know, Schmidt Center for, you know, ballet and yoga to be built, but the city has to match it. And so the city says, wow, Schmidt is giving $1 million and we have to put in $3 million, but this is a great opportunity. And so there are a lot of things that are done that I think if you went out and asked people getting up early in the morning and going to their two jobs, you know, do we really need this? Does the city want to use its tax money this way? They would say, no, I don't think so. I mean, very often these things are passed through initiatives that are, you know, highly skewed, where most people don't bother to go and vote, you know, if it's a bond issue or something like that.
At some point,
cities are building crazy stuff. I mean, huge sports complexes that they can't fill and so on.
Well, at some point, we should probably examine what the Norwegians have done. This is a big Scandinavian country. I'm half, you know, Iowa, and I'm half Norwegian. But the Norwegians have all this revenue from oil because they have been drilling in the sea, the North Sea. And yet they have not spent the money like drunken sailors. They have actually recognized, one, that probably at some future point in time, we're not going to be using oil, and therefore they can't be dependent on it. They have literally, they've reined in their appetite. They have reined in their appetite because they have more accurately predicted the future than us. And there are ways of doing it. The question is, can we use those models and learn from them?
And
that's the only
question. The European countries that have offshore oil drilling all require a very different safety cutoff valve on all of the rigs, which have recommended to our companies, but which they didn't install because we don't require it.
Well, Dick Cheney said it was too expensive. It cost $500,000.
That's right.
Well, if we want to be like Norway, what we need to do is just make sitting in a sauna the number one recreation, because that doesn't cost all that much.
It doesn't cost that much.
Okay, so
one more question.
We have to eat lutefisk, too.
Arnie, you've been talking about consequences, and you've been talking about, you know, trying to not rein in the spending. I want to bring up one other thing that has come up and get a reaction. China is worried about their housing market, and they see these other countries that have gone through housing crises and bubbles. So they're trying to limit a lot of this speculation and people trying to view property as just a means to make money. So they're putting restrictions on the number of homes you can buy. They're putting restrictions on lending. Is China being prudent, or are they being restrictive of the freedoms of their people?
They're a communist country, so we can't do anything.
Well, no. I think if you look at housing as a home and not as an ATM machine, then you know what? You can do what China does. Because China is saying that we are looking at this for the purposes of shelter. We are not looking at this as a purpose of making cash.
But
and how many TV shows were on HGTV about flip this house? No, honey, live in this house.
But you can say
we have a whole new role model.
But the same is true with cars. You know, you don't need two cars. So we limited one. Why do you need two children or three or four children?
No, it's not the same.
Arnie, doesn't that limit some capitalistic freedoms?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? What did we just say? The excesses of capitalism caused the failure. The excesses of socialism caused the failure. We have to start figuring out how you rein it in. And whether it's a government action, whether it's a personal ethic, whether it's a community ethic, at some point in time, you have to start recognizing that too much ain't good for you or for anybody
else. But you can do that through disincentives so that people won't want to take the risk of investing badly. You know, rather than doing it by expropriation
Remember, a house is not an ATM machine.
It sounds like a good conversation over some lutefisk in the sauna.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa today. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Lindsay Moon and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can send them to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan All. Thanks for joining us.